All Ireland, the Munster branch of the Grand Slam was it? Paul, is that right?
The Munster Heat, that's right.
The Munster Heat, yeah. Which I got into the last six or something. There will be a day of judgment about that. I'm like a bit like Father Ted here. I'm going to make a speech about that. No. I'm delighted to be here again. And thank you, Paul, for inviting me. It seems like a very relaxed and friendly place to read a few poems. So if I can get the slur out of my voice, I'll begin by reading some poems from this collection, my most recent collection, Life Monitor, published by Pat Cotter of Three Spires Press. Three Spires Press. That's a bit of a teaser, that. This one is called Girl at Station Exit in the Snow. And this poem, I was on my way to Canterbury because my wife was getting a degree there, and we were taking this small trundle train somewhere between Gatwick and Canterbury, and we stopped at a station, and I remember my wife and my son were playing a game of cards, and I was just looking out the window. It was in January, it was a bitterly cold day. It's called Girl at Station Exit in the Snow. She's reading a poster about works and closures at the station gate in a flurry of snow. As she reads, she frowns and runs her fingers along a strand of her chestnut hair. Welcome to Godstone, a platform sign proclaims. Snow in a generous scattering all around, each flake at play in the abundance of time, taking its own time to reach the ground, or watching for their proper port of call, they hesitate and levitate and cross. Intent the eyes of snowflakes as they fall, eyes only for the homing place. And a girl running her fingers through a strand of hair as she takes the note of him, now turns her head to go, then looks again, her dark eyes moving among flakes of snow. Next one is called Life Monitor. This is the title poem of this collection, and it's actually caught myself looking in on my 13-year-old son's bedroom, a habit which I had had which began when he was an infant, and suddenly realizing there's no fear of caught death anymore. No, but why are you still doing this? Looking in to make sure that he's still breathing. So the poem is based on that kind of discrepancy between when there was a reason for doing it and there wasn't really any longer a reason, unless he couldn't sleep from having too much drink. But he wasn't drinking. It was when I was 14, Life Monitor. This sanctuary I visit still, where my son's body is curled in the slump of sleep. Such a great spread beneath the blankets, who was once so small, I stand and wonder at his girth. Only occasionally now I call, where I used to go morning and night and listen, fearful of caught death. certain rhythm of his breath. Now he has turned 13 and knows how to measure a curved line or determine the volume of irregular solids like himself, gels his hair with American Crew, and worries about the first spot on his chin. Morning comes jingling through along the edges of the blind and down the hazy spines of shadows. Here in the first light is a holy place, a simple chapel where I still incline to hear the sermon of the essential, his breathings rise and fall. The next poem, we go to the other end of the spectrum of life. This one is called Survivor. He has showered and it is evening, and although he is a man of ordinary sorrows, fading into the hills and lake and pastures, logs stacked against the wall of the farmhouse make a gentle crackling like the start of rain. Not for him so far the lot of such disasters has split the normal from never the same in an instant, an invisible axis blow. Still stepping sure-footed on the rim, others have fallen over. He'll dress and go, forgetting anxious thoughts, those darting lizards, in company and quantities of wine, fighting the good fight of the minor pleasures, planning his next break into the sun of snow. As regards the dark, this poem I'm dedicating tonight to James Kelly. James Kelly is a poet who sells his poetry outside a hotel on O'Connell Street in Limerick. And the second last time I met him was at a Fecal Traditional Music Festival, where I gave a reading with Terry Murray. And James was absolutely plastered. He had this thing of when Terry Murray was reading, every now and then he would go over to her and kneel in front of her and say, "Terry, you're wonderful." The one good thing he said was, when I read this poem at the Fecal Festival, he said, "Good man yourself!" And I met him, he was coming out of the station in Limerick today when I was going in, and he muttered something about, "Give up the good poetry." So that's why I'm dedicating it to him tonight, as regards the dark. Tell me now, as regards the dark, how far did you go into it? I didn't go too far in, far enough, further than I bargained for into the dark. Have you plans to return into the dark? I have plans not to return there, insofar as one is able to plan not to return into the dark. And tell me this as regards the dark. What did you find when you went not too far, but far enough, further than you bargained for, into the dark? What I found when I went into the dark further than I bargained for and far enough to make me have plans, insofar as I'm able never to return to it, though I didn't go too far in, was something darker than I bargained for, and that was dark enough. I'm going to read this one because it's coming up to St. Patrick's Day now, and there's a story behind this. I was asked to write it for an edition of Poetry Ireland that was kind of a, back in 2003 was objecting to the invasion of Iraq, not objecting to, but writing anti-war poems or poems that deplored the existence of war and the fact that things had to be settled by war. So the thing that set me off writing this poem was to see a photograph on the Irish Times on the 13th of March 2003 of Bertie Ahern presenting a bowl of shamrock to the then President of the United States, George W. Bush. I was also doing, I was teaching in the College of Art and Design in Limerick, and I was doing a course on art and the unconscious mind, in which I was dealing with certain surrealist painters, such as Giorgio Di Chirico, is the one in particular here. And Giorgio Di Chirico has a painting called The Uncertainty of the Poet, which shows a headless female torso beside a big bunch of bananas. And I bring that into the poem as well. And it's called A Gift for the President. Quotation is, Mr. Bush's appearance today to receive a bowl of shamrock from the Taoiseach, Mr. Ahern, at the White House, Irish Times, 13th of March, 2003. I hold seminars on this sort of thing. Why, I ask my art students, is there a bunch of bananas beside the female torso in Di Chirico's The Uncertainty of the Poet? And one student says, this is presumably the poet uncertain how she can eat a banana without a hand to pick it up or a mouth to put it in. The problem with surrealism is how much more surreal it can get the more you tease it out. Therefore, those art commentators are wise who remain deadpan. What we see here, I say, is the unexpected juxtaposition of a twisted classical female torso and a bunch of bananas. And another student asks, why are there trains in the background? Di Chirico always has trains in the background. It's kind of his signature. The other problem with surrealism is that it's not confined to art. Why, I ask, is there a big bunch of shamrock in the Taoiseach's bowl? And the promising student says, this is the unexpected juxtaposition of a bellicose American president and a bowl of shamrock in the hands of an abject Irish Prime Minister. Here the classical and Renaissance sense of calm, balance and harmony is distorted to make the scene more sinister and disturbing. Good, good, very good, excellent. And why are there planes in the background? The president always has planes. It's kind of his signature. Right. I'll just read one more from this book, and then I'll go on to some new poems, and then maybe come back for a couple in the book again. This one is called Grief, and it's, I think it's, this one, frankly, is influenced by Elizabeth Bishop's, what I consider a wonderful sonnet called One Heart. The one that the art of grieving is not hard to master. Look it up. Grief. It's loss that grieves me, not the loss of keys. Though I've lost many keys in my lifetime, I'm some way grieved for them. Likewise with hats I need where the sun permanently rages. Glasses I've lost, and maps and mobile phones, and grieved for directions, lists of names and numbers. I lost my passport and the key of sleep, and listened all night to a shutter banging in an empty house. Under a fig tree's shade, I write big like a child, but have lost my margins. Straining to catch recognizable accents beyond this garden where I shut myself, green on all sides of me was one, and that the wall, the cliff face of my foreign nest. I mistake the sound of water for a voice, loved and familiar. Yet I understand that nothing is familiar anymore. And home, the strangest place of all to be. A door leads to the difficult unknown. Grief, with its lack of keys, has locked me in. This one is called The Message from Olympia. This is the famous painting by Manet, Edward Manet, in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, where the sitter is portrayed as a Parisian prostitute who is receiving a gift of flowers through her black servant from a client, which caused a great scandal back in the 19th century in Paris. In this poem, Olympia, or Olympe, as they call her in French, is actually speaking to me. You'll find me presently in room number 14. If you want to love me, forget the other one, who stares out of the canvas far too brazenly. I, Olympia, would like to see you again, and wonder why you have ignored me for so long. Don't spend too much time with Caillebotte's floor planers, or Bouguereau's nymphs and satyrs, or the sweet-toothed dancers at Renoir's Moulin. I too have a sweet tooth for galettes. Beware the tricksters who approach you in the street and pretend to pick a gold ring off the ground. Gold rings like me are treasures not easily come by. Look at the bunch of flowers my maid is giving me. It's from a statesman. He's quite close to Bonaparte. With powerful men apart, I'm very partial to poets and artists. Manet was the making of me, and Baudelaire was bawdy with me once or twice. In the orangery, Paul plays thinking of death, and as for Monet's wall-to-wall lily pads, they are fine in their way, if it's lily pads you want. When a young woman hands you a 5 euro note, don't treat her the same as those peddlers of false gold. You'll have dropped it searching pockets for your metro ticket. At Place de la Concorde, pause to remember me. In the sweep of the river passing under bridges, bearing boats and trippers, they shimmer in the summer heat. This one is called Catch, and in brackets with an anecdote of Ed Reavy. Ed Reavy was a famous Irish musician who lived in Philadelphia for most of his life and composed a lot of traditional Irish music, i.e. new reels, jigs and hornpipes that came into the tradition with a very haunting quality. And he had this story or myth that these tunes came to him from, you know, fairies or somewhere outside our terrestrial circumference, you know. So I heard this story from his son, whom I met at the cabin for that closed last year. So I'm embellishing this a bit, but this is more or less about inspiration in general. It's called Catch, with an anecdote of head reading. It is good for poets to take their notebooks to bed with them, for musicians to sleep within an arm's reach of their instruments. Not in vain have I been granted this talent, a lantern of the mind that wakes me up. This morning when my son called in to ask about his roster in my plumbing business, I told him that the first thing he must do was listen to the tune I caught last night. I played it and the boy approved my reel. The insomnia that's attendant on this gift, to slip from beside your dear one and move with the fox's briskness to a private place, a den of soundproof comfort. Believe me, this is a dear one who won't wait around. Last night I sat to play, not knowing what I'd make of the small tumult in my head, finding and losing form. But when I set the bow to string, the tune took off alone, a nice cue moving on its melted water. The copper mines of Peru. This one is has very little to do with the copper mine of Peru. I don't think it needs much explanation. A sullen-faced youngster is getting out of his father's car. He's had a bad childhood. I had a bad childhood too, but I got over it. Look at me. I am going through the cycles of eternal recurrence. Unlike my father did to me, I never laid a hand on him, and yet what his eyes are saying every time I look at him is that I have failed him, that I embarrass him, that my very existence was the cause of his bad childhood. What he needs is a good front, but you can't get away with that nowadays. I'm driving him to school, but he doesn't want to be driven to school. Above all, he doesn't want me to drive him to school. And if he must be driven to school, it should be in a Merc or a Beamer. But what he really, really wants is to have his own Merc or Beamer and drive himself to school. Would he be happy with that? No, there'd be something else biting him. Someday one of his pals would descend to school in a helicopter. Then he'd want a fucking helicopter. And would that take the perpetual sulk off his face? Would he get a life then? You can be certain he wouldn't, because I'd buy him a shit helicopter, having mortgaged the house to pay for it, and sold my wife into slavery, and sent his younger brother and sister to work in the copper mines of Peru, while other fathers would buy his classmates brand new, classy, twin jet engined helicopters. His would only be second hand with a single piston engine, and not one of the girls in the school would ask him for a lift. And if I tried to reason with him, "Son, you can take it from me. Oh, Jesus, not that again," he'd say. "Let me talk, you little fucker," I'd say. And he'd throw his eyes to heaven, heaving a petulant sigh. "You can take it from me," I'd say, "that if a girl likes you, really likes you, she won't care if your helicopter is shit. It's you, not your helicopter, she'll want. Your personality." "Tell that to the Marines," he'd say. "Anyway, I don't have a personality. I had a bad childhood, remember?" And this is how it would finish. We'd settle down in our sleeping bags. in the cabin of the Shiz helicopter, parked on a flat rock on the top of a mountain. I miss Mom and Billy and Frida, I'd say. So do I, he'd say. Fuck you and your teenage angst. Fuck you and your Shiz helicopter. Night, son. Night, Dad. This one I wrote last week, and it's an unusual poem. It just shows you that what we were talking about earlier. Keep at it, you know, things start changing. I don't know where this is going, and maybe it was off, but it's just a poem in which I try to do a commentary on strophe number 13. Do you know Wallace Stevens' famous poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird? Are you familiar with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the 13th strophe, in which I think it's one of the moments when poetry actually reaches a kind of a silence, you know, that words actually create a silence. And how it goes is this: it was evening all afternoon, it was snowing and it was going to snow. The blackbird sat in the cedar things. So I tried to do a gloss on it. The blackbird is the place within you which events cannot reach. Like a sound sleep, this place is without coming or going, and yet remains in touch with everything that matters. I really can't describe this place. Of course, it's not a place at all. How can a blackbird be a place? A blackbird is in a place among the cedar limbs and is simultaneously a symbol and a blackbird. Keep going. Working on our house, a builder's laborer discovered a bird's nest under the eaves in a rusty gutter. The bird's nest is a bird's nest and also a symbol for the heart. Soul is an ugly word. It has been overused to the point of extinction. Heart isn't far behind. It is better to speak of the blackbird and cedar limbs. Love has the same problem as soul and heart. And if it hadn't been for the snow and the cedar limbs and the evening which lasted all afternoon, the blackbird in stroke 13 might as well have been a magpie. Keep going. I don't want to keep going because I don't think I can put it clearer than Wallace Stevens. I could bring Zen down on you, or the Tao, hit you with an Upanishad. But you should be reading more, meditating more. What's the point of me telling you when you're not disposed to get the point? And when I say you, I mean me. And when I say me, I mean me. And which me, if any, is the blackbird? Is there a blackbird in me at all? Is there a bird's nest under my eaves? There have indeed been many birds' nests, and a lot of them are under eaves. And not a few are in rusty gutters and discovered by builders' labourers. And it's easy to talk the talk, but to walk the walk that leads to the place within, which is not a place at all, or even a blackbird, is a very different matter. Keep going. And love has been known to exist without its name. It has been known to get on fine without its name, or any other name. As for the soul, I have issues. And while psyche is too Greek, beware the Greeks bearing gifts. I have to admit, the psyche sat in the cedar limbs as a certain ring to it. Finish up now. The blackbird was waiting for the poet to finish writing, and the prospect of crumbs from his evening afternoon's tea. The psyche was waiting for the poet to put the blackbird in the cedar limbs. And this one is a kind of a spin-off from that. A bit more cynical, I suppose. A lot more cynical, to be quite frank. Phrasebook. I haven't heard much from love these days. If you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. It wasn't so much silence as the idea of silence that bothered me. The idea that love wouldn't speak to me surpassed all the pains I've ever had in the ass. Mind you, I think that silent love can be fine when push comes to shove. There's too much talk of the phenomenon by couples no sooner met than gone again. And when I came upon a foreign phrasebook in a car boot sale, I had a quick look at the page with the list of helpful phrases and saw that I love you, sure as blazes, was there in the middle, and right below it was another phrase, in case you blow it. There were terrible twins, the two of these. I love you. Call the police. This is a fact. I saw these two phrases quite close together as helpful phrases. I'll just finish up with two poems from my collection, my most recent collection. The White Mule. People have asked me, people have asked me, the white mule in this poem, is there something symbolic about it? In fact, I was in this canner. I rented a holiday home about 5 or 6 years ago to try and finish a memoir for a month during the summer. And I used to take a walk every day along the seashore, and I encountered this house, farmhouse, in which there was a white mule. And but I heard the white mule before I actually saw it, because you know, when you're trying to concentrate on writing, at least when I tried to concentrate on writing, the slightest sound is a distraction, and this white mule was braying regularly. At least I assume, seeing the white mule nearby, that this was the source of thing. Anyway, I don't think, some people say, if you're talking about colonialism, you're talking about the oppression of you know, it wasn't in my mind at all, at least not in my conscious mind when I was writing this. The white mule. The white mule's trope marks the passing of time, an angelus braying. The tide has one tune for always, a tune with a turning. Mussels in rock crevices pray for the sea to turn its tune, to come back swollen with nutrients, swill over them again. The sky and the sea are quite an item and lead an exemplary couple's life. One is not bright when the other is dark. Though on some skyless days the sea in the distance seems to laugh to itself, as if not just the presence but the thought of the sky would brighten it. The tide has one tune for always, and the bray of the white mule marks time for the land. It's pale green fields, it's hillocks, cottages and crows. I would speak backwards as a child into my throat, and everyone laughed at the strange ebbing sound of words. Now there's one I can actually recite by heart. It's called Turnip, so I'll end up with that. Turnip. This is a great favourite in Limerick, anyway. I don't know about Cork. Cork is, of course, a different place than Limerick. Very different. Camping in Lisbon here, camping in Lisbon there. Right? We need to get together, guys, and fight the common enemy.
What's that? Minster, is it?
Ah, yes. Declan Kidney is from Leinster, isn't he?
No. I know where he's from.
Right, anyway. This poem is called Turnip. The boy with the acne at the cash register didn't know what the code for turnip was, and had to shout across to the girl at the cash register on the other side, who shouted back, "It's T-U-R." The button for T-U-R on the cash register was caked with deposits of the ages and coated with cobwebs. Apparently no one had bought a turnip for centuries. The button beside it was for T-U-T. The boy king sent to early mummy cloths. The lad of the acne looked at me, pity in his eyes, and asked, "Is that all?" I wanted to tell him that turnips were the salvation of my father in the hungry 30s. He stole them from the fields and ate them raw, only for turnips. I would not be here today. But all I said was, "Yes, that's all." And the lad pressed the button and I paid. Left with my solid swede, which is another name for a turnip, especially in the UK, where the latter is something different, smaller and white. A turnip keeps me cheerful in November, strong tasting, resonant of contentment when diced and boiled, buttered and peppered. It brings a golden comfort in cold weather, and conjures up in its own selfless way a feeling of protection and good order, of sleeping safe and sound in bed. I think the world should be run by a turnip. Thank you very much.